welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. We got to focus on constitutional compliance. We need to continue to appeal to heaven and learn, pray, and act in so doing. And so with that, I also forgot to continue letting you know that I'm more than willing to step in as president for a campaign on 2028 campaign. We just need true constitutional electors to actually run. We've got to take the Electoral College away from the party because they have no constitutional authority to have it. So, as it stands, if you're interested in supporting a constitutional presidential campaign, let us know. Anyway, welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
And we are in the midst of the Pennsylvania debates. And folks, so where are we? Let me kind of bring everybody up to speed. We are on Friday, December 7th, Pearl Harbor Day. They didn't have Pearl Harbor back then, but anyway, we're on the third jurisdiction note that is in the document, and you'll find that on page 57. So without any further ado, go ahead.
Okay. I will mention further an object that I take to be a particular magnitude, and I conceive these regulations will produce its accomplishment. The object, Mr. President, that I allude to is the improvement of our domestic navigation, the instrument of trade between the several states. Private credit, which fell to decay from the destruction of public credit by a too inefficient general government, will be restored, and this valuable intercourse among ourselves must give an increase to those useful improvements that will astonish the world. At present, how are we circumstanced? Merchants of eminence will tell you that they cannot trust their property to the laws of the state in which their correspondents live. Their friend may die and may be succeeded by a representative of a very different character. If there is any particular objection that did not occur to me on this part of the Constitution, gentlemen will mention it, and I hope when this article is examined, it will be found to contain nothing but what is proper to be annexed to the general government. The next clause, so far as it gives original jurisdiction in cases affecting ambassadors, I apprehend is perfectly unexceptionable.
Okay, so he's kind of still going through this jurisdiction. And, let's go ahead and go through this. Because this is kind of a long oration, but he's kind of focused on what the judiciary can really do. So go ahead.
Okay. It was thought proper to give the citizens of foreign states full opportunity of obtaining justice in the general courts, and this they have by its appellate jurisdiction. Therefore, in order to restore credit with those foreign states, that part of the article is necessary. I believe the alteration that will take place in their minds when they learn the operation of this clause will be a great and important advantage to our country. Nor is it anything but justice. They ought to have the same security against the state laws that may be made that the citizens have, because regulations ought to be equally just in the one case as in the other. Further, it is necessary in order to preserve peace with foreign nations. Let us suppose the case that a wicked law is made in some of the states enabling a debtor to pay his creditor with the fourth, fifth, or sixth part of the real value of the debt. And this creditor, a foreigner, complains to his prince or sovereign of the injustice that has been done him. What can that prince or sovereign do? Bound by inclination as well as duty to redress the wrong his subject sustains from the hand of the perfidy, he cannot apply to the particular guilty state, because he knows that, by the Articles of Confederation, it is declared that no state shall enter into treaties. He must therefore apply to the United States. The United States must be accountable. My subject has received a flagrant injury. Do me justice, or I will do my justice. Myself justice. If the United States are answerable for the injury, ought they not to possess the means of compelling the faulty state to repair it? They ought, and this is what is done here. For now, if complaint is made in consequence of such injustice, Congress can answer. Why did not your subject apply to the general court, where the unequal and partial laws of a particular state would have no force? In two cases, the Supreme Court has original jurisdiction that affecting ambassadors and when a state shall be a party. It is true, it has appellate jurisdiction in more, but it will have it under such restrictions as the Congress shall ordain. I believe that any gentleman possessed of experience or knowledge on this subject will agree that it was impossible to go further with any safety or propriety, that it was best left in the manner in which it stands now.
Okay.
Let me keep going.
Yeah.
In all the other cases before mentioned, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction, both as law and fact.
Okay.
The jurisdiction.
Okay. So right there.
Okay.
Sorry, but right there, does it have the ability to interpret? Does it have the ability to redefine or take law and fact and interpret it differently?
No.
So the concept that the judiciary can seek a greater justice because of his conscience, because the moral good demands it, is not allowed. Remember, we're not a nation of whims and characters. We're a nation of law, and that the law is fixed. So they can only judge cases in the appellate jurisdiction. It is based to law and fact. Very few things go into the federal court on original jurisdiction. Okay? So, anyway, keep going.
Okay, the jurisdiction as to fact may be thought improper, but those possessed of information on this head see that it is necessary. We find it essentially necessary from the ample experience we have had in the courts of admiralty with regard to captures. Those gentlemen who during the late war had their vessels retaken know well what a poor chance they would have when those vessels were taken in their states and tried by juries, and in what a situation they would have been if the Court of Appeals had not been possessed of authority to reconsider and set aside the verdicts of those juries. Attempts were made by some of the states to destroy this power, but it has been confirmed in every instance. There are other cases in which it will be necessary, and will not Congress better regulate them as they rise from time to time than could have been done by the convention? Besides, if the regulation shall be attended with inconvenience, the Congress can alter them as soon as discovered. But anything done in convention must remain unalterable but by the power of the citizens of the United States at large. I think these reasons will show that the powers given to the Supreme Court are not only safe, but constitute a wise and valuable part of the system.
So for America to be successful, for this new government experience, they have to have, the foreign nations that we're going to deal with in trade, because we have to have trade. And because we can't make everything, we can't do everything, so we want to have trade. And so we actually have to have an assurance to the nations and the proprietors, the businesses, and so forth, that we are not going to basically play games with them. The Articles of Confederation does not have a judiciary. They bring it up as necessary, and it has been a joke. It was a joke, because the states were undermining them in almost all the things they were creating, treaties and so forth. The Articles of Confederation, as much that there are people today give it lip service, they are clueless with the fact that the people back then that were operating within the states literally just, I mean, they treated it like toilet paper. So, I don't understand why there's this righteous elevation of that particular document in governing when it had proven impotent and inept. So, anyway, now we're going to jump into the next day, and we're going to deal with a little bit of slavery. So let's go ahead and go through this oration.
The Honorable Gentleman from Fayette, Mr. Smiley, the other evening claimed for the minority the merit of contending for the rights of mankind, and he told us that it has been the practice of all ages to treat such minorities with contempt. He further took the liberty of observing that if the majority have the power, they do not want the inclination to consign the minority to punishment. I know that claim, self-made, form no small part of the merits to which we have heard undisguised pretenses, but it is one thing to claim, and it is another thing very different indeed to support that claim. The minority, sir, are contending for the rights of mankind. What then are the majority contending for? If the minority are contending for the rights of mankind, the majority must be contending for the doctrines of tyranny and slavery. Is it probable that this is the case? Who are the majority in this assembly? Are they not the people? Are they not the representatives of the people as well as the minority? Were they not elected by the people as well as the minority? Were they not elected by the greater part of the people? Have we a single right separate from the rights of the people? Can we forge letters for others that will not be clasped round our own limbs? Can we make heavy chains that shall not cramp the growth of our own posterity? On what fancied distinction shall the minority assume to themselves the merit of contending for the rights of mankind? Sir, if the system proposed by the late convention and the conduct of its advocates who have appeared in this House deserve the declarations and insinuations that have been made concerning them, may we exclaim, ill-fated America, thy crisis was approaching. Perhaps it was come. Thy various interests were neglected. Thy most sacred rights were insecure. Without a government, without energy, without confidence internally, without respect externally, the advantages of society were lost to thee. In such a situation, distressed but not despairing, thou desiredst to resume thy native vigor and to lay the foundation of future empire. Thou selected a number of thy sons to meet together for the purpose. The selected and honored characters met, but horrid to tell, they not only consented, but they combined in an aristocratic system calculated and intended to enslave their country. Unhappy Pennsylvania, though as part of a union, must share in its unfortunate fate, for when this system, after being laid before the citizens, comes before the delegates selected by them for its consideration, there are found but three of the numerous members that have virtue enough to raise their voices in support of the rights of mankind. America, particularly Pennsylvania, must be ill-starred, indeed, if this is a true state of the case.
Okay, so
I trust we may address our country in far other language.
Okay, so let me go to the front end of this, because what you just read was a long quote. And that was interesting language, because, sir, if the system proposed by the late convention, he's talking about this new constitution, and the conduct of its advocates who have appeared in this House deserved the declarations and insinuations that have been made concerning them, well, may we exclaim? And then they kind of go through this, and they basically say, wow, I mean, it's almost like they're being damned by these anti-federalists. In other words, when we get involved in politics, and we can see this today, as we start dealing with the left and even the right as far as conservative and progressive, those who want a theocracy, those who want a godless theocracy, in other words, communism, they're basically two sides of the same coin. And so they're not going to go happily into the land of liberty unless they start understanding how misinformed and how actually ill-informed and how programmed they have been to believe that a theocracy is better. I was thinking to myself before today's show that how many people, because we can count on, you know, pretty accurate in the modern day, how many people died due to this theocratic revolution of communism? And when I say theocratic revolution, we're literally talking about a secular, godless government inflicting godlessness upon people. In other words, instead of giving you a Bible, they take your Bible and they say there should be no God. And we look at, from the French Revolution, of 1790 was the first failed attempt of a communist revolution. The communist plan kind of went out from the communes because the people were starving. They were ripe for revolution. And as they started revolting, the despotism of Napoleon Bonaparte kind of rose up from the ranks, and he hijacked their revolution and just converted it into his own despotic rule. So they didn't get rid of God. They didn't create communism. So it was a failed attempt. So going from France to today, from the Killing Fields, all of these different endeavors of purging the ranks of Christians, educated people, and so forth, we know that there have been millions of people died in Russia, China, in Cambodia, and so forth. So anyway, my question is this, and this is what I was pondering. Is there an empirical data source that could actually identify how many people have died in the name of religion and you know, their faiths? And, you know, when we look, because that gets added to this communist revolution stuff, because that's equally religious. Those are religious revolutions. So when we look at the cause of the scourge upon society, in other words, the wars and death is a scourge upon our societies throughout the annals of history, the cause of that has more to do with the desire of dictating and controlling the religion. Now, the framers, because I already read Madison's Remonstrance on Religion, the framers started recognizing that, you know, every person has their own conscience. Every person has their own relationship with their Redeemer, their Creator, so forth. And so how much more precious is it to preserve your individual right than it is to actually inflict your faith upon someone else? And so this is why it kind of amazes me, because a lot of people don't even say the words because they just, maybe they don't want to taste them. Why is it that out of the 13 colonies, because they all had their own religious bent, you know, they had their own faith and way of, you know, operating as a state and people. How come the Lord didn't raise one of them up to be greater and to basically control the rest of them? You know, like in the Bible, right?
Mm-hmm.
How come that didn't happen? Because I don't believe he's taking favor towards one or the other. Because I think that we jest. We have no clue, really. Because even in the scriptures, as a matter of fact, as an analogy, and I know I just went down a rat hole, so I got to get out of this quick. The the reality is, why do we have so many pages of scriptures in the Bible? Because mankind is behaving badly. I mean, the scriptures, you know, we don't have pages and pages and pages. Good job. Keep it up. That's how you do it. Yes. You know, thou faithful servant, blah, blah, blah. Right? I mean, the scriptures aren't filled with that. They're filled with admonishments and corrections and, you know, what a pity fool or what have you. Woe unto thee. And so the reason, I mean, I understand the dispensations of prophets and so forth. But when it really comes down to it, even in the dispensations of prophets, there have been, you know, nations that have gone astray. As a matter of fact, Israel had to have a king after 400 years of having a prophet. Mm-hmm. Oh, we got to have a king. And so, in other words, they even rejected the government that was created for them 400 years later. So the point I'm trying to, you know, if you'd indulge me, is if we really looked, why would we want to continue having such an intimate relationship with government and our faith when we're far better off having our government protect our individual faith, our individual conscience, and our right of religious expression? I mean, it's one thing for government to create laws of decency. You can do that. It is inappropriate for a child who doesn't have the cognitive ability to see, you know, mature, erotic, or what type of material. They should not be exposed to that. You know, and we've created, and empirical data has guided us on this. Empirical data has proven that a child does not mature to, and technically, the child is not really mature at 18 when they're voting. Most people say we're probably better off at 21, maybe a little bit later. And actually, when you look at how the framers did it, it was based on, you know, your voting rights and you became a true adult or man or what have you when you could go out, buy, and possess property. That means that you have now entered into society with a true, I'll just say, engagement. That, you know, you're vested. This is not something that, I can abandon this, just walk away. Like today. I mean, well, I'm just going to go live in my parents' basement. So, anyway, as we look at this and we start understanding the magnitude of the problems that we have created, and what he's talking about here is these indignations of this Constitution, where it actually preserved that. It set the stage to allow states to actually start to, you know, the people in the states to be able to take a stand and go, hey, because had the Constitution never came to be, we would probably either be Anglican or Catholic today. Because that was where the dominance was in the large states.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, anyway, we got less than a minute, and I know we're going to go through some more, but, but, you know, he's reading some, I'll just say, some poignant material here where, you know, there's a lot of feelings, and there's obviously how these men, you know, they suffered these indignations. And, you know, as a matter of fact, we know that with the Kentucky resolutions, where Jefferson basically, you know, we can only lament with the insinuations that have been slung at us. And so I find it fascinating, the, you know, how well they spoke, how well they put things on the table. There may have been political correctness, but when it came down to really arguing, the sleeves got rolled up and the fist came out. And they spoke very candidly, but they didn't lose, you know, their control with expletives and those types of things. They still had respect for each other, the good gentleman and so forth. So they never really, that motherless child or these types of personal insults that we sling today. Anyway, so when we come back, we'll have Tammy dive back into this, the next part of this slavery and this talk about slavery and so forth. Because bottom line, they were abolitionists. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so Pennsylvania itself was one of these first states of abolition. They did not want to embrace it kind of from the get-go, and they were kind of a unique state. They were a unique state of kind of freedom from religion type of state where, you know, they were very tolerant with other religions. They didn't want to afflict it. So they were, I guess, the classic liberals back in those days. Right. And when you look at the commerce, they were capitalists. They were, you know, venturing and looking, you know, to forge forward into these markets and so forth, where Pennsylvania wasn't. I mean, they definitely had a different paradigm, which is one of the reasons why in the Pennsylvania debates, we actually hear these words coming out that talk and say disparaging comments regarding the institution of slavery, and where we already saw the fact that Wilson was basically forecasting that this Constitution is going to eradicate it. So anyway, let's keep going. Go ahead and pick it up with okay. Happy America.
Okay. Happy America, thy crisis was indeed alarming, but thy situation was not desperate. We had confidence in our country, though on whichever side we turned, we were presented with scenes of distress. Though the jarring interests of the various states and the different habits and inclinations of their inhabitants all lay in the way and rendered our prospect gloomy and discouraging indeed, yet such were the generous and mutual sacrifices offered up that amidst 42 members who represented 12 of the United States, there were only 3 who did not attest the instrument as a confirmation of its goodness. Happy Pennsylvania, this plan has been laid before thy citizens for consideration. They have sent delegates to express their voice and listen with rapture, listen. From only 3, opposition has been heard against it. From only 3, yeah. From only 3, opposition has been heard against it.
Okay, so clearly this is a positive comment within the papers. Now, keep on going.
The singular unanimity that has attended the whole progress of their business will, in the minds of those considerate men who have not had opportunity to examine the general and particular interests of their country, prove to their satisfaction that it is an excellent constitution and worthy to be adopted, ordained, and established by the people of the United States. After having viewed the arguments drawn from probability, whether this is a good or a bad system, whether those who contend for it or those who contend against it contend for the rights of mankind, let us step forward and examine the fact. We were told some days ago by the honorable gentleman from Westmoreland, Mr. Finley, when speaking of this system and its objects, that the convention no doubt thought they were forming a compact or contract of the greatest importance. Sir, I confess I was much surprised at so late a stage of the debate to hear such principles maintained. It was a matter of surprise to see the great leading principle of this system still so very much misunderstood. The convention, no doubt, thought they were forming a contract I cannot answer for what every member thought, but I believe it cannot be said that they thought they were making a contract, because I cannot discover the least trace of a compact in that system. There can be no compact unless there are more parties than one. It is a new doctrine that one can make a compact with himself. The convention were forming compacts. With whom? I know no bargains that were made there. I am unable to conceive who the parties could be. The state governments make a bargain one with another. That is the doctrine that is endeavored to be established by gentlemen in opposition, that state sovereignties wish to be represented. But far other were the ideas of the convention, and far other are those conveyed in the system itself.
Okay, so he goes on, and you may want to continue reading on, because he's really playing with this idea that they weren't out there to create a compact. They were really trying to just fix the governing system. And they realized that it needed to make so many different changes that there was just no way that this could just quickly, you know, plug and play. This was not a plug and play thing. They needed to make sure, just like the Articles of Confederation, needed to be ratified. So what does the word ratified mean? If you go Google the word ratified or ratify, ratify is a formal process of accepting or rejecting, making a decision regarding a treaty, a contract, or a compact. In other words, ratification is a contract law term. Does that make sense? They are in the process of accepting or rejecting this constitution. So when the first state accepts it, they stand alone as a party to the compact. Now, when the next state comes in, are they making a compact with the federal government, or are they making a compact to themselves, or are they making a compact with the other states in the union? What do you think?
With the other states.
That's right. That's why they called it a union. So it was a one-to-many. So the first state basically comes in and says, we're going to ratify this, and we accept all states that enter into this agreement to, you know, basically put what we have here in this compact in force. There can be no, you can't use any imagination. You cannot wander down the path of saying, oh, well, we want to actually, you know, make it up as we go along. No. Now, if there's language in the Constitution to go ahead and make things up as you go along, then, okay, yeah, you're accepting that. But there's nothing like that in this Constitution. This is why we created the color-coded Constitution of enumerations in the Constitution. So we actually identify what line you're reading, such as the apportionment for representation in Article 1, Section 1. What you're reading right there is literally a responsibility and a role and a standard for the states in basically appointing a representative to represent people of that state. So in other words, it's nothing that they have a power to create a law on. This is what they have to do, and this is how they have to do it. So the Constitution is very, very clear as how they laid it all out. There's no ambiguity. I defy anybody to really come up and say, well, that's really ambiguous. Most people say the General Defense and Welfare Clause at the beginning of Article 1, Section 8, is ambiguous. It has ambiguity to it. But actually, it's not a clause, or is it a statement? It is a preamble. There are three preambles in the Constitution. The very first preamble, in the first preamble, we the people establishing for general welfare, is that delegating any power? No, it is a preamble to basically say this following document we're accepting as our government to for the betterment of our society. They use general welfare, but for the betterment of our society, same. Not to give them something, but to protect their fundamental rights and the things that were precious to them, their property and their lives and their liberties. So the Bill of Rights contains another preamble. That is the third preamble in the Constitution. So the very first preamble, the preamble to the powers enumerated in Article 1, Section 8, and the preamble to the Bill of Rights. So everybody understands what these following articles, these following, powers, what these following amendments are for. So that there's no doubt why these amendments are being added, why these powers are being granted, and so forth. So as we kind of look at how he goes through this, Wilson is not a gift of concise and short. That's why some of these orations could just go on and on and on. And he's a good man. He was a very righteous man, and very religious and so forth. But when it comes down to understanding what he's basically saying here, is that this Constitution was not in force when it was written and handed to Continental Congress. The directions within the Constitution right after the signatures, what Continental Congress needed to do is they needed to basically, if they accept this, then they need to basically forward it out to the states for ratification, and 9 states need to ratify it, and the process and all of that. And it's to be done in convention, not in the state legislatures. They did that to ensure that the corrupt power bases in these large states could not thwart the Constitution. That right there is the key. Because as we look at the states and the paradigm that the state legislature, and because I think Wilson kind of alludes to this, that the state legislatures are the sovereigns. But he also talks about, and he brings it up a lot, that we the people are the sovereigns. And so I'm not going to say, he confuses anything. I just think that the way he uses his words can help somebody kind of see the big picture, but it's not as clear as when you're dealing with somebody like Madison, somebody like Nicholas, and so forth and so on. Even anti-federalists are pretty, clear and concise, but you can tell he's probably more of either an educator, he's definitely an orator, he's a statesman, and so forth. But anyway, let's go down to the next one, which is the amendment part, where he talks about this.
Okay, if we go a little further on this subject, I think we shall see that the doctrine of original compact cannot be supported consistently with the best principles of government. If we admit it, we exclude the idea of amendment, because a contract once entered into between the governor and governed becomes obligatory and cannot be altered but by the mutual consent of both parties. The citizens of United America, I presume, do not wish to stand on that footing with those to whom, from convenience, they please to delegate the exercise of the general powers necessary for sustaining and preserving the Union. They wish a principle established by the operation of which the legislatures may feel the direct authority of the people. The people possessing that authority will continue to exercise it by amending and improving their own work. This Constitution may be found to have defects in it, hence amendments may become necessary, but the idea of a government founded on contract destroys the means of improvement. We heal it every time the gentlemen are up. Shall we violate the Confederation, which directs every alteration that is thought necessary to be established by the state legislatures only? Sir, those gentlemen must ascend to a higher source. The people fetter themselves by no contract. If your state legislatures have cramped themselves by compact, it was done without the authority of the people, who alone possessed the supreme power.
Okay, so I think that's where you really see how this breaks out. Because this is where he basically says that in the compact, and in those days, so contract law has been around years and years and years and centuries and millennia, going back to the very beginning, right? To Adam and Eve. I mean, the Bible and those types of things talk about covenants, compacts, agreements. And so the concept of a contract possessing the ability to amend it by the parties. Now, it's one thing to say the subordinate can make any changes they want. Then you might as well give the subordinate general powers. In other words, when you look at constitutions around the world at this point in time, they basically gave the kings, the rulers, full power. And the what they did was they used a Bill of Rights to preserve, you know, their rights or those things that they kept precious. You can't, you can do anything you want, but you can't do these things to us. And so we've covered this already, but the fallacy is that you can't list, you know, everything that you want to protect. And so they went down this path of being very specific and very detailed and minute on the things granted. And therefore, within this, if there was a point in time where the federal government or the states decided to adopt change, grant a new power, take away a power, what have you, there is a mode of doing it that would not require 100% acquiescence. 100% agreement. And so they created a new standard. These things were unfathomable. In other words, can we actually, we put it down in paper. Do we think that's a good idea? Well, here is a perfect case of empirical data. They had a document for not barely 10 years, right? 1787, when the Constitutional Convention mm-hmm. was being held, the Articles of Confederation were penned 10 years before that. And they had already seen the problems of requiring a unanimous decision by all the states to make a change. And they said, that's not going to work. And nobody could fathom any other way in a contract of allowing it otherwise. And they actually did it. All they had to do was say, we're lowering the standard from 100% to 75%. 3/4. And there you go. Mm-hmm. So anyway, the concepts were being pushed and broken by this Constitution, because if you were going to school and studied contract law back in 1788, this concept of a contract being able to be altered by a, you know, just a majority of the parties instead of 100% of the parties in a compact, that would have been unfathomable. Well, how do you do it? Well, we just actually put it into the compact that you can do this, and this is how you'll do it. Isn't that amazing? They just did it. So anyway, go ahead. Let's dive into the commerce now, the next one.
Okay. What is to be done to effect these great purposes if an impost should be found insufficient? Suppose a war was suddenly declared against us by a foreign power possessed of a formidable navy. Our navigation would be laid prostrate. Our impost must cease, and shall our existence as a nation depend upon the peaceful navigation of our seas? A strong exertion of maritime power on the part of an enemy might deprive us of these sources of revenue in a few months. It may suit honorable gentlemen who live at the western extremity of the state, of this state, that they should contribute nothing by internal taxes to the support of the general government. They care not what restraints are laid upon our commerce, for what is the commerce of Pennsylvania to the inhabitants on the other side of the Allegheny Mountains? But though it may suit them, it does not suit those in the lower part of the state, who are by far the most numerous. Nor can we agree that our safety should depend altogether upon a revenue arising from commerce.
Okay, keep going.
Excise may be a necessary mode of taxation. It takes place in most states already.
Uh-huh, go ahead.
Do you want me to keep going?
Yeah.
Okay. The capitation tax is mentioned as one of those that are exceptionable. In some states, that mode of taxation is used, but I believe in many it would be received with great reluctance. There are one or two states where it is constantly in use and without any difficulties and inconveniences arising from it. An excise, in its very principles, is an improper tax if it could be avoided, but yet it has been a source of revenue in Pennsylvania both before the Revolution and since, during all which time we have enjoyed the benefit of free government.
Okay, so an excise is where it's kind of like the stamp acts, where they impose a very flat tax, like one penny a gallon or whatever the measure is, so that as you buy it, there is a tax based on what you're consuming or what you're purchasing. That's an excise. It's kind of like a sales tax, but it is only placed on certain items. A sales tax is basically, well, they even have played with this because sales tax on everything but food. Some states do that. So they're just pointing out that if they were going to survive on imposts, that would actually be a greater tax on the coastal region than it would be on the interior, because the interior may not even deal with much commerce going through the coastal region. Does that make sense? You're building your own furniture. You're not buying anything that's coming through those ports. You're not even sending anything out. And so to be truthful and fair, the impost for the longest time were the primary source of income for the United States. And because we were capable of having a free market, we were capable of actually doing a good job of paying for things, and not only doing a good job of paying for things, they were paying for things they should have been paying for and using those imposts and covering them. It wasn't until Wilson's administration where he said, we're going to buy ourselves into prosperity. And so he wanted to implement the income tax to do that, because they wanted to spend a lot more money than what the impost could cover. And to be fiscally sound, they needed to convert the tax system to be one of income tax. Ergo, they, went down this path. But see, the Constitution did not allow them to spend money on things they didn't have the authority. But they didn't want you to know that. By that point in time, everybody had already bought off on the idea, well, the Democrats and the Republicans, they're all doing it, and they're not saying it's wrong, so I guess they can do it. And that's kind of how we got into this mess. But anyway, let's dive down to the Supreme.
There is no doubt, sir, but under this Constitution, treaties will become the supreme law of the land, nor is there any doubt but the Senate and President possess the power of making them. But though the treaties are to have the force of laws, they are in some important respects very different from other acts of legislation. In making laws, our own consent alone is necessary. In forming treaties, the concurrence of another power becomes necessary. Treaties, sir, are truly contracts or compacts between the different states, nations, or princes who find it convenient or necessary to enter into them. Some gentlemen are of opinion that the power of making treaties should have been placed in the legislature at large. There are, however, reasons that operate with the great force on the other side. Treaties are frequently, especially in time of war, of such a nature that it would be extremely improper to publish them or even commit the secret of their negotiation to any great number of persons. For my part, I am not an advocate for secrecy in transactions relating to the public, not generally even in forming treaties, because I think that the history of the diplomatic corps will evince, even in that great department of politics, the truth of an old adage that honesty is the best policy, and this is the conduct of the most able negotiators. Yet sometimes secrecy may be necessary, and therefore it becomes an argument against committing the knowledge of these transactions to too many persons. But in their nature, treaties originate differently from laws. They are made by equal parties and each side has half of the bargain to make. They will be made between us and the powers at the distance of 3,000 miles. A long series of negotiation will frequently precede them, and can be the opinion of these gentlemen that the legislature should be in session during this whole time? It well deserves to be remarked that though the House of Representatives possess no active part in making treaties, yet their legislative authority will be found to have strong restraining influence upon both President and Senate. In England, if the King and his ministers find themselves during their negotiation to be embarrassed because of an existing law is not repealed or a new law is not enacted, they give notice to the legislature of their situation and inform them that it will be necessary, before the treaty can operate, that some law be repealed or some be made. And will not the same thing take place here? Shall less prudence, less caution, less moderation take place among those who negotiate treaties for the United States than among those who negotiate them for the other nations of the earth? And let it be attended to that even in the making of treaties, the states are immediately represented, and the people immediately represented.
That may be a different play from immediately, but less immediate, right? I don't know.
Okay.
But you're doing great because this is difficult language. So go ahead.
Two of the constituent parts of government must concur in making them. Neither the President nor the Senate solely can complete a treaty. They are checks upon each other and are so balanced as to produce security to the people.
Right. Now, I find it interesting that it never came up regarding treaties being made, at least in Pennsylvania, that, you know, nobody challenged the idea, well, what's going to happen if they make a treaty that they don't have the authority to make? Is that even possible? So far, it hasn't come up yet. It did come up in Virginia, though, and they only needed in one place to actually help stipulate those conditions. Mm-hmm. But anyway, let's dive into money next week.
Yeah.
Okay. Because this is going to be a little bit longer, but this is, I love the discussions on money because almost all of the states air their dirty laundry to say, look, we're guilty of, you know, running a fiat currency, blah, 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 blah. And so I love it when I see, you know, that they're actually being honest and poking each other in the eye to say, look, we're guilty of this. So anyway, thank you so much. Again, you're doing a great job. As a matter of fact, folks, if you've been reading along, you'll notice that she's actually correcting misspelled words or what have you, and, you know, doing a good job because it makes sense, like fetters and letters instead of fetters and so forth. And actually, there was a point of fettered, and it was appropriate when you actually read it and made sense. So anyway, good job. Keep it up. Okay, folks, so with that, we're going to be back next week with more Pennsylvania debates. As far as me and my content, I'm going to be biting my tongue. I want to get through the content, but I've got some real complaints about what the heck's going on in D.C. and then the world and so forth. But I want to get through these content shows that I need to wrap up on these treaties and so forth. I'm J.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.